What do we want? EFL discussion and narrative. When do we want it? Now. Opposite me, George Ellick putting the G into XG. My name's Ali Maxwell. What a busy weekend it was across the EFL. We're going to start at championship level. It's a traditional time of year, and we're not breaking from tradition. We've got Leeds and West Brom winning their sixth games in a row at the top and pulling clear because the chasing pack, like many of us this time of year, is very congested. 11 teams now within just 6 points of each other from fifth down to 15th. And of course, we'll touch on a couple of massive games that took place at the bottom of the championship. George Ellick, kick us off by talking about West Brom, I think. Sunday's game at noon saw them wipe the floor with Swansea. 5-1 winners, six league wins in a row. How quickly are any concerns or any queries, I suppose, you had about this team as a title contender vanishing when you see a performance like this one?
Yeah, pretty quickly. I think it's more their league position and their points haul, which is putting pay to any concerns one might have over their aspirations to get promoted. As Slaven Bilic said, they're now 10 points clear of third. And barring a ridiculous turnaround in form for West Brom, that 10 points is very, very hard to get back over. I mean, how many games are there left of the season? 26. So 10 points in 26 games. The bottom end of the table isn't too bad, because then if you're picking up points, you're doing so at a far higher rate. But the top end of the table, where, you know, you'd have to assume that West Brom, even if their form did dip, would still be collecting points fairly frequently. 10 points is hard to do. I mean, I think with this game, I couldn't watch it live, annoyingly, but I've obviously watched the highlights back. And Swansea were the architects for their own downfall, for the most part, with their goals. West Brom clearly dominated the game itself and were worthy winners, but I think they will have trickier tests to come, which is funny to say that, because obviously Swansea are currently in 11th position. They're a top half team. They've been undergoing a difficult run of form, and it looks like this is kind of, I guess this result was probably coming against one of the stronger teams. But West Brom again proving that under Slaven Bilic, they are one of the best teams in the league. It kind of feels like they've already gone through their bad run of form early on in the season, when they couldn't stop conceding goals, but they were picking up the wins to go alongside it. Mm. So it would take a brave man now to think they won't finish in the top two.
I think Swansea can tell any future opponents of West Brom two fairly key things not to do. Don't give the ball away in your own half, because the pace with which West Bromwich Albion can make you pay, and did make Swansea pay, is alarming. Up there with the very best teams we've seen at this level, with the quality that they have. Give those guys any space to play into, and they are punishing teams. But also, when you're attacking, don't overcommit players, for the same reason. If there were a few turnovers when Swansea had possession in the final third for West Brom, that very quickly turned into West Brom creating a chance. As a counter-attacking side, as a side in transition, they are absolutely deadly. I just want to talk about Matty Pereira all day, every day at the moment. It's a love that has blossomed into something quite spectacular, I must say. And yesterday was just like, it was like the best date you've ever been on with a partner that you've fallen for. It's just getting better and better. Three assists. The last one was, you know, he helped a ball on that had come to him, which was finished off by Edwards. But there's two other assists. A reverse ball slid through to Hal Robson-Kanu, and a floated chip, little dink across to Matt Phillips, were both absolutely sublime. I remember the first proper moment that caught my eye with Pereira was a reverse ball that he played against QPR, when he was tucked in off the right hand side and he played a beautiful, beautiful pass. And since then, we've seen a whole array of quality from him. His link up with Deon Garner and Gibbs down the left side is absolutely fantastic. But the goal as well that he scored, which was a lovely finish, just such accuracy, such quality in his left foot. And he's racking up the numbers as well. This isn't a sort of romantic thing. This isn't based on aesthetics. This is based on output as well. 5 goals and 10 assists in his last 15 games, which is the most goal contributions in the league in that spell. The ridiculous part of this is West Brom are going to sign him in January for £9 million. That's what's been reported as part of the loan agreement. That was the price that is set. And they're going to buy him for £9 million. I would suggest that based on what he's done in the first few months at this level and what he's done on previous loans in the Bundesliga and others, based on his skill set and specifically for me, his consistency, because there's a classic cliche that foreign players are going to come over to the Championship and they're going to struggle in November and December when it gets cold. Not a bit of it for Matty Pereira. He can certainly hack it. He's already worth, based on all of the above, what, 20, 25 million pounds? Based on players we've seen do similar things. Absolutely sensational, and West Brom flying clear. Leeds beat Huddersfield 2-0. Notable, I guess, because in XG terms, this game was very, very even, which is a rarity for Leeds games. So I think credit kind of goes to Huddersfield here. I spoke so much last week about Leeds' system, meaning that they dominate every game in terms of chances, blah, blah, blah. But Huddersfield gave as good as they got. And if it wasn't for Kessié and a bit of poor finishing, they would have racked up a couple of goals here. So, you know, congrats to Leeds. Two bits of quality, really. Alioski's goal, his strike from outside the box for the first, and Jack Harrison's cross for Pablo Hernandez the second. Harrison, a reminder to me, as much as anyone else, but certainly some Leeds fans, that player development is a thing, that young players can and do improve considerably when they're being well coached and when they're playing a lot of football. Haven't always been his biggest fan at times in this Leeds side, but he's been excellent in the last few weeks and months. And George, the best game on the weekend on paper beforehand was probably Fulham against Bristol City. And it didn't disappoint, did it? Bristol City leaving with all 3 points. A bit of a caveat. Probably should have been a draw with a questionable penalty appeal, or rather a questionable penalty denial from the ref. But we sort of, and I don't like giving us too much credit, and sometimes we get things wrong, but we sort of called this.
Well, I think we called Fulham's struggles, but we also may have been a bit premature in not writing off, but I don't think maybe we've given Bristol City a lot of praise this season. I mean, I stand by the fact that I think that earlier on this season they picked up points in games that they didn't deserve to. I stand by the fact that they weren't particularly impressive. They were impressive, but the 5-2 result against Huddersfield the other day wasn't necessarily a 5-goal showing, I would say. But here again, I mean, they were without the ball for most of the game. I think Fulham had 68% possession.
But when they had it.
But they were very good when they had it. I think, again, Nodge played very well in the middle of the park, and Brownhill getting on the score sheet again, and Eliasson providing that balance on the left. It all kind of makes sense, and good to see Big Fam getting in amongst the goals again, because I think him and Vyman should work as a front too. And so with this Bristol City team, you have to, you know, you think in the similar way that I said about West Brom, like if it is the case that they went through a period where they weren't playing up to standard, but they've managed to pick up points in those games, and now as the injuries ease, maybe they are a team who can challenge towards the top end of that table. I mean, for Fulham, it's very, very troubling indeed to have another match at home where they have a lot of the ball, only managed to score one goal. They've dropped 3 points here again. If I had to ask you now who I thought would finish above higher come the end of the season, I think I'd probably still say Fulham. Mm.
But we're still yet to see Bristol City convince when they are the team expected to win a game, especially at home at Ashton Gate, with a team coming in to play for a 0-0, to play for a point. And in the second half of the season, as top teams become established and as teams down at the bottom, you know, realise their status, I suppose, we see that a little bit more. And that is where they have always, always flattered to deceive. So the reason I said we kind of called it was not we said Bristol City are amazing. It was more the fact that we said that performance last weekend and that personnel and shape seems to suit them. We said Fulham probably better suited to playing away from home at the moment because of the way teams are able to A, keep them at bay for large swathes of the game, but also how easily they can get at the Fulham back line and how vulnerable they look. Those centre-backs, Ream and Mawson, you know, they're big names at this level, big name centre backs. But the last few weeks we've seen them, they've looked very, very vulnerable indeed. And Bristol City, as we've said before, they just are better suited to playing away from home. So maybe a less surprising result for us than for some others, and a great win away from home for Bristol City. And yes, we don't think that.
And if there's ever a good advert for the betting show, then that is it, because you called it. So it's not It's after timing, but justifiably so, because you plucked it out.
Yeah, not always the case, but that was a good one. George, let's talk about those big games at the bottom. Luton-Wigan was something that we spoke about quite a lot last week. We discussed Luton getting thrashed by Brentford on a couple of different platforms. We previewed this one on Friday night on Sky. It felt like we were kind of leaning towards Wigan to some extent here. And at halftime, you couldn't have been put off that. This was a game of two halves, as the cliche goes. But in fairness to Luton and Graham Jones, it didn't look like a set of players that are not playing for their manager, because the rally and the equaliser and the winning goals in the last 15 minutes of the game just changed the whole outlook of the club, because that was a must not lose game.
Well, it's changed the whole outlook of the Championship at that end of the table. I mean, Wigan winning this game 1-0 would have pushed them above Luton in the table, would have dropped Luton further towards the relegation zone. Those 5 minutes, I mean, McManaman scored the equaliser in the 87th minute, and then George Moncur scored in the 92nd after Shea Dunkley had been sent off. And again, I mean, Graham Jones said after the game that he was very impressed by the way that his team and his players managed to find a way to win the game. I think the way they found to win this game was thanks to another self-destruction from Wigan, which is becoming just part of their consistently getting in, throwing away any decent position they get into the match. Their last two games, they've been leading well into the second half and then come away from 0 points from either. Dunkley being sent off in injury time and then them conceding indirectly from a corner is just an absolute shocker. And you've got to look for people in this team and people within the management to step up and take responsibility. And at the moment, no one at Wigan's doing that. So I come out of this still fearful for Luton, because again, they were 3 minutes away from losing this game 1-0 at home to Wigan, who hadn't won an away game for quite some time. And you've got to be very, very worried for Paul Cook. And I'm kind of surprised that we're speaking right now and not about a managerial casualty.
Yeah, a couple of contributors for Luton that haven't featured much this season were Luke Berry, who played from the start. It felt like the midfield diamond needed something a bit different, and Berry was provided for that and did well. And then Moncur, of course, off the bench, stealing the headlines with the winning goal. I seem to remember him doing that a couple of times last season in League One as well. Another heartbreaking part of the narrative for Wigan was Callum McManaman being on the score sheet for Luton. Of course, such a key part of really Wigan's best moment in the modern era, that FA Cup final win against Man City a few years ago. But as you mentioned, the current trend of Wigan at the end of games across the whole season in the last 10 minutes of matches in the league, they have conceded 10 goals and they haven't scored a single one. There was a big win also for Middlesbrough, who beat Charlton. There's now only 3 points between Middlesbrough and Charlton, which 6 weeks ago would have seemed crazy. And it's unfortunately, from a Charlton perspective, not because Borough have been on some crazy winning run. But Woodgate has certainly loosened his tie somewhat in the last few weeks with a win against Barnsley 1-0 at home and a win against Charlton 1-0 at home. Neither of them necessarily dominant, neither of them catching the eye particularly for an incredible performance, but getting the work, getting the job done, and boy do they need it. Out of the relegation zone now, and the tougher tests will be coming for them, and they need to stand up to them. They've now got a team, thanks to injuries and thanks to a couple of the older guard being phased out, they are actually playing the youth, the young players that Woodgate said he was going to start bringing through when he was appointed. They finished the game with Dale Fry, who obviously came through their youth system, Pears in goal, who's filling in for Randolph, Hayden Coulson, the left wing back, and Jed Spence, who made his first start on Saturday. He's a right back and he really caught the eye. He looked really, really good, very comfortable, and Woodgate afterwards was really bigging him up, saying it was his spot to lose now. So Jed Spence is a name for us to keep an eye on. They've also got Marcus Tavernier starting, Stephen Walker coming off the bench as well. So lots of academy and youth representation in Middlesbrough's first team, which is a positive for them going forward, and a good result as well. Charlton's decline continues in the face of a growing injury list and suspension list. And
that's I think the big takeaway from this is, you know, for Middlesbrough, it's an important home win. They probably would have liked to have made it a bit more comfortable in terms of the scoreline, but in reality, the match itself was comfortable. Charlton 1-0 down after 1 minute, only mustered five shots in the entire game. A Wade or Middlesbrough team who we've seen fairly often this season be kind of dominated. Three of those came from Conor Gallagher from range. Lyle Taylor coming off the bench will be mightily important and heartening for the Charlton fans and for Lee Bowyer. But if we're looking at teams at the moment at this kind of getting towards halfway stage whose position may be a false one, pains me to say it, but I think Charlton have to start trying to arrest the slide fairly quickly, or pretty soon they're going to be one of the teams we're talking about, you know, looking for survival. And it was only a few weeks ago that everyone was talking about how well they've been doing. So fingers crossed they can, you know, plug the hole a little bit.
Mm. There was a playoff battle of sorts between Sheffield Wednesday and Brentford. Another classic championship game of two halves. Brentford going ahead from a set piece. I did tweet saying, did not expect Brentford to be scoring from a corner away at Sheffield Wednesday. And to a few listeners or followers' credit, it was pointed out, A, that they've got a new set-piece coach who will be working very hard on those, and B, Julian Berner, the Sheffield Wednesday centre-back who heads everything away, is missing at the moment. So their fans actually weren't that surprised about that. But Sheffield Wednesday turned it around in the second half and got a deserved win. I mean, what a crazily notable centre-forward display from Stephen Fletcher. An absolute man reborn, George, which is surprising to some, but something that you'd pointed out might happen under Gary Monk when Monk was appointed.
Yeah, it's interesting you call it a tussle between two playoff-chasing sides, given that Sheffield Wednesday might quite soon be occupying one of the lower places in the division due to the FFP stuff that's going on at the moment. But Stephen Fletcher is the latest in a long line of players who, strikers who haven't necessarily been particularly prolific earlier in their career, who under Gary Monk really find a scoring touch. He's now scored 10 goals in 19 games this season, but he joins a list. You know, you think of Chris Wood, for example, who, you know, he's now playing in the Premier League basically because of the run of scoring that he had under Gary Monk. You've got Shea Adams, exactly the same, who's, you know, struggling now, having left the Championship in, having scored, have a prolific season last season. His strike partner, Lukas Jukovic, exactly the same. Wilfred Bonny at Swansea. So, Gary, if you're a chairman with a striker that you can't really get a tune out of, Gary Monk's seemingly the guy to turn to, because these guys are prolific under him. They don't necessarily kick on after him. But and Fletcher is the latest person to seemingly be loving it. He scored four goals in the last two games, five in his last four.
Long may it continue. So basically, you want to play for Gary Monk, you want to play for Brentford because their striker in the last few years always seems to reach about 20 goals and then get sold for loads, or Peterborough in League One if you have to drop down there. Those are the three. Any young strikers listening, that's who you should aim to play for. Yeah. Especially if you've got a bit of size about you, Gary Monk, probably the best option. It does look like Fletcher's in best shape I can remember seeing him. I was surprised to find out that his best ever goals tally is only 12 in the league, which he's obviously well on course to breaking. I think he's on 10 or 11
now. He's on 10 now, yeah.
Really, really impressive. And just a good second half performance from Sheffield Wednesday. Bees this season, unlike previous seasons, have been very good defensively. I think second best defence in the league going into the weekend, joint with Nottingham Forest. So for them to be 1-0 up, that compared to many previous years where you'd have thought, especially if you're at home to Bees, you could probably swing that one fairly easily. That's not necessarily the case with Bees this year. So, especially because this is a Sheffield Wednesday side that hadn't won a game having gone behind for 2 years and 3 months.
Wow.
Which is a stat I read in a piece by Nancy Frostick, who covers the Sheffield Wednesday ongoing case on and off the pitch for The Athletic. The Athletic, sponsors of the podcast, and Nancy covering Sheffield Wednesday, probably stretching her journalistic qualities, I suppose, at this stage, because it's not just about covering the team. As you referenced there, a very large and ongoing battle now with the EFL, with potential sanctions. Just to remind anyone listening who's not up to date with this, the alleged misconduct is related to how much and when the club sold their Hillsborough Stadium to Chan Ziri, the chairman, in an attempt to avoid breaking the rules. There's all sorts of potential punishments being floated, one of them being a 21-point penalty. And in Nancy's piece, George, just at the start of this week, Wednesday win the battle, but fans are worried about the war. She really gives an overview of the situation very well, not just what they've done wrong, but actually how the fans are viewing this, because as the piece outlines, it's a really tricky spot to be in for a Sheffield Wednesday fan. Here's a governing body in the EFL that you are predisposed to be pretty angry with when something like this happens, but also a couple of people looking inwards at Mr. Chanziri and kind of the way that he's run this club. And it comes back to always this gamble to try and get to the Premier League. They're in a tricky spot. What did you make of the piece?
Yeah, I think the interesting point that Nancy makes is that it's an interesting time for Brentford and Sheffield Wednesday to meet each other, because Brentford are probably the poster boy of Championship clubs in the way that you should be run, unlike Sheffield Wednesday.
Gary Monk certainly seems to think so.
And that's exactly what Monk says. You know, the quotes in the piece from Monk says, "I just think Brentford is a great example of a club that has had a plan over the last 3 or 4 years, where they did a lot of recruitment in terms of recruiting to sell. This season, they have invested in that squad. It's probably a sign they feel ready with the stability and how they've gone about their job to now turn it into a season where they are going to push for promotion." It's fairly pointed, I would say, Gary Monk making comments praising another club's recruitment policy and the way that they're run. Because even though he is doing a fantastic job there and he's getting results and he's pushed them into sixth position, it's going to be mightily frustrating to him that, for no fault of his own, the likelihood is that they're going to be drop points, which is going to impact their season. He'll probably also feel like going forward he would love the support and to have a similar recruitment style to Brentford, unlike the way that Sheffield Wednesday have operated in the last few years. So significant in itself, I would say, that Monk is the person here praising another club for the way they go about things. But some irony, I guess, that on the day it was Sheffield Wednesday who came out on top.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as the piece makes fairly clear, Sheffield Wednesday's issues, their flirtations with FFP limitations and boundaries, started because of purely ambitious recruitment, to use a good word, poor recruitment, to use a more honest version. One of the phrases Gary Monk used about Brentford was basically buying players to sell them on, a selling club. And that's a sort of phrase that fans don't take kindly to hearing. They certainly, no one wants their club to be a selling club. And yet it's clearly and obviously the best way to run your club at this level, and almost the opposite of what Sheffield Wednesday have done. It's very clear, looking back at their recruitment history, that after they made that playoff final in 2015-16, where they had a fantastic squad, Forestieri at the top of his game, they had spent a decent amount of money the summer before. Transfermarkt reckons around 13-14 million quid on Forestieri, Hooper, Marco Matias, Lucas Joao, and various others. That summer afterwards, it was he twisted, didn't he? They signed Adam Reach and Alman Abdi, Morgan Fox and Winnell, all for fees. It was another £10 million of outgoings. But the problem that they discovered that they had, I imagine, quite quickly was, aside from Forestieri and a few others, they didn't have many assets. And the average age of the squad seemed to be getting higher each year. Now, that's not a great way of developing a recruitment process that is going to help you make money in order to spend money on players. Instead, they were spending money on players and not getting anything back. Jordan Rhodes compounded the issue when they signed him for £10 million the season after that. So, look, it's something that I think is really interesting. Chanziri came in clearly passionate, clearly ambitious, and put a lot of money into the club. And all of those things, as a fan, you're thinking at the time, brilliant, perfect. We've got a guy who wants to be here, who wants to help the club get to the Premier League, where we all want to be, and he's willing to part with his money to do that. But actually, it's such a risk, and it can be so damaging and dangerous for a club if that gamble fails. Now, we don't know how damaging yet for Sheffield Wednesday. We do know that they're in a spot of bother. I would just say to people listening, try to think of your club's mid to long-term plan. Try and work out what's going to happen in a few years' time, because if you just focus on the amount of money that your chairman is giving you to spend in the transfer market, then you're focusing on the wrong thing, I think. So something to think about. Nancy's article on The Athletic from Monday morning. Wednesday win the battle, but fans worried about the war. If you want to read that piece and all sorts of other good football writing, the best around, in fact, we've got an offer code for you. You can get a free trial and then 50% off going forward. If you head to theathletic.co.uk/NTT20, all sorts of good stuff on there. And podcasts now as well, including one that I host with Michael Cox, the Zonal Marking Podcast, which I think we would all recommend very, very highly. George, a few more games just to touch on quickly in the Championship. Which one would you like to talk about first when I run you through QPR 2, Preston 0, Cardiff 3, Barnsley 2, Blackburn 1, Derby 0, Stoke 1, Hull 2, and Reading 2, Birmingham 3? I don't think I'm getting James Alexander Gordon's job anytime soon. What's your favourite one out of that lot?
My favourite one, or the one I want to talk about, I think we need to give credit to QPR and their clean sheet. The last club in the country to keep a clean sheet.
25 games.
Doing it against the top scorers in the league, or at least they were. I don't know if they still are. But a massive result for them. I've had it confirmed to me today that, so we can remember this going forward, his name is Eberi Eze. Not easy. So going forward, let's all, you know, make a concerted effort to call him by his real name, because he's, you know, certainly good enough to warrant it. But good to see Eze getting another couple of goals here. And they were largely comfortable. They only conceded 8 shots to Preston. I mean, Preston's dip in form is pretty alarming stuff. That's 3 games with 0 points, 0 goals, and conceding, I think it's 8 in those games. 7. 8 in the last 4 games, so 4 defeats in a row, which is going to be a concern for them. When I said that their scoring rate wasn't going to continue, I didn't expect them to suddenly go 4 games without netting. And it doesn't get much easier with Fulham at home coming up midweek.
There does come a time where defensive injuries being the reason for a bad run, that can kind of only fly for so long. Not to say that they don't still have personnel out and injured, but at a certain point, you just have to work out another way. And that's where Preston are finding it difficult at the moment. Blackburn 1, Derby 0, not a classic, that's for sure. Really poor performance from Derby. The defending for their Blackburn goal, I thought, was bizarre. Corey Evans had the ball just inside the Derby half, central midfield player, and there was absolutely no pressure on him. And you'd think that's fine. Not every team has to press. Maybe it's something that they've spoken about. Let Evans have the ball. You know, he's not exactly the most creative passer. You know, everything was fine at that point. But they had every man between Evans and the goal. And you think, well, if you're going to set yourself up like that, you have to make sure that you deny that pass through the middle into the front man, which they didn't do. A simple pass into Armstrong. And you think, okay, given you're all back there anyway, if it does get through, let's get nice and tight to Armstrong. Let's make sure he can't just receive the ball and turn and get a shot away. And they didn't do that either. So it was a fantastic finish from Armstrong, but such poor defending. And it got me wondering about Armstrong, because he's only 22. It feels like he's been around for ages. I remember him scoring a goal for Barnsley that we talked about on the podcast as one of the best goals we'd ever seen. He's played over 200 times at senior level, loads of loans, obviously, from Newcastle. Settled now at Blackburn, where he mostly plays on the wing, the right wing this season, left wing last season. He's obviously not an out-and-out winger. I would have him down as a sort of goal-scoring wide forward, but his goal return's not that good. 5-44 last season, 4-20 this time round, so maybe on course for 10, something like that. It's just an interesting one, because he is still young, but he's played so much, you wonder how much someone develops after their 200th game, for example. He's capable of sublime goals like he scored on Saturday, but we also saw the other side, which was potentially that he's not the finisher that he was touted as being when he was so young in the Newcastle setup. He was so highly rated. Some of his closer range finishing leaves a little to be desired, which I thought was interesting. You can't say the same for Jarrod Bowen. J-Rod.
Jarrod.
10 goals in 9 games, 2 goals at Stoke on the weekend, Hull beating Stoke, which made it 3 defeats in a row for Michael O'Neill's Stoke side. But, I mean, it's all about Bowen, isn't it? Because I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to talk about him for, George.
No, you wouldn't have thought of him much longer. although you can be pretty sure that Hull will be desperate to keep hold of him at least till the summer. But if there's, you know, I'd say Bowen and Eze are the two championship players at the moment, you know, not including Pereira because he's on loan currently. They've got to be the two players who look elite, and they're playing for two clubs who are wedged in mid-table, which won't help their chance of keeping hold of them because there's no possibility really of Hull or QPR getting to the Premier League next season in case, unless something very, very drastic happens. But again, it was just his finishing ability. He's just so deadly from that range. His pinpoint accuracy and his movement in and around the area. I say around because, you know, he picks up the ball from distance and is also so, so deadly, as we saw with the first goal. So he is someone who we love to watch. We can't imagine we're going to have him for much longer. But then this time last year, we probably thought the same, and he's still there. And Grant McCann only has very, very positive things to say about him and his attitude and the way that he approaches, you know, his work. Because you've got to assume that he is aware that given his age and his talent and his goal-scoring record, he is set to have a pretty exciting few years.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see where he ends up. It felt like a Premier League weekend, if I may talk about it briefly, of players that we know and love having moved up from the Championship and catching the eye. It's, I think, quite easy to forget, given his meteoric rise, that James Maddison was at this level two seasons ago, playing for a mid-table Norwich side. You've got Harvey Barnes starting for Leicester as well, who was in the Championship at the start of last season, albeit on loan. And tearing it up. You've got Grealish, of course. I don't think we need to go on about him. Daniel James, a nailed-on starter now for Manchester United. And while they might not be in the best shape, winning away at Man City. And, you know, when we talk about these players, when we get really excited about these players, the great thing for us is, when we're talking about a second-tier player, is we can be so confident that it will translate to a higher level. We don't bang on about every single player because then that would lose a little bit of meaning, I think. But I feel really confident when there are guys that we're just so keen on that we can be pretty sure they're going to be tearing it up. The notable exception at the moment in the Prem is Che Adams, who's having a tricky time breaking into the Southampton team, having had a fairly barren start to the season. So that's one.
Totally barren, isn't it?
Totally barren. Fully barren. But his old team, Birmingham, got a great away win at Reading. Reading still struggling without Swift and Ajaria, which I think most teams would, but especially this Reading side, for whom they do represent the real creative force, the creative thrust. But I like this Birmingham team, and I feel like they've been evolving a little bit throughout the season. From where they were to start the season, the sort of performances they were putting in, and as they shed their Gary Monk skin and moved into their Pep Clotet skin. That makes it sound like I'm calling someone a snake, which I'm absolutely not. But now you look at their team, and McEachran started his first game on the weekend. Highest amount of passes in the game. They dominated the ball against Reading. Not too surprising, given that we know Reading don't want it. Bowen just wants them to be hard to beat, wants them to win second balls. But yeah, this Birmingham side with Crowley in it as well. Sunjic at the base of midfield, and Bellingham playing tucked in behind the striker, who is just continuing to play so well. I mean, 17 years old. When you see his movement, when you see his first touch, his ability to drift past defenders, an ability to play with his head up that you don't see from any 17-year-olds. I mean, it's so exciting. And Bella, who they only signed a few weeks ago, scoring a free kick as well. So really good vibes, I think, really, at the moment for Birmingham, and quite good to watch as well. Lastly, Cardiff 3, Barnsley 2. My big stat, which I never got off on the betting show, was that combined XG in the Championship, the team whose games has the highest combined XG, so their attacking output plus their defensive output, has Cardiff City, which, considering they came down from the Premier League with Neil Warnock in charge, certainly on the defensive side of things, was not what we were expecting. But Barnsley, again, even with Neil Harris in charge now, another team that were able to play through them pretty much at will, caused them a lot of problems. It didn't look like a classic Cardiff performance, but they did get the win here, 3-2. What can you say about Barnsley that we haven't said already? Their defence is so bad, so porous. It's the seventh time this season they've scored two goals in a league game and not won that game, which is pretty horrendous. So And Lee Tomlin, I suppose, is the other note from that game. Si Watts, who's a good friend of the pod, was doing the voiceover on Quest, mentioned Harris giving the players pizza as a sort of bonus at the moment, but Tomlin having lost 2 stone in the summer in the shape of his life, hopefully, probably abstaining from that, I reckon. But he is their sort of key man at the moment, really getting involved.
I just find it so difficult to understand Cardiff's defensive issues, because on every level, you look at the manager, previous manager Neil Warnock, who has made his career out of building very, very solid teams. Neil Harris, you could, you know, even his biggest detractor would have to say that a Millwall, he largely made them solid, even at the worst of times. And then the personnel as well. I mean, you've got Curtis Nelson's managed to kind of force his way into the team, and he would be the one where you'd understand if he was struggling to acclimatise to life at Cardiff. But by all reports, he's the one who's giving a good account of himself. And then with the likes of Flint and Morrison, you know, really experienced centre backs at that level. So yeah, surprising to see with Cardiff. I mean, it's a magnificent result for them, and it's great for them to get those. Is it 3 wins on the bounce now for Neil Harris? But you have to think that he's got to sort out their defensive shape at some stage. And exactly the same thing can be said of Gerhard Struber and Barnsley, where all, you know, they can play as much good football as they like. They can look as bright going forward. Great to see Chapin putting in another fantastic performance. But whilst they are so bad at the back, whilst they give away opportunities so freely, it's going to be impossible for them to make any kind of mark on this league. Impossible for them to try and survive.
How about some League One action now, George, where the great winners of the League One weekend were Wickham, who didn't play. Still top of the table, because out of the top 12, certainly, only 2 teams won, and that was Blackpool and Bristol Rovers. So aside from Wickham, Blackpool and Bristol Rovers, probably the big takeaways from this weekend, but it could not have gone better for Wickham, really. There were some good quality draws between decent teams, Coventry and Ipswich, of course, Portsmouth and Peterborough as well. But very happy days for Gareth Ainsworth, who I spent the day with in at Quest. Just an absolutely wonderful bloke. I'm sad to say, because, you know, when you see someone who is doing such a good job, who is universally popular within the game, who players speak very highly of, who's done an amazing job on a small budget, you sort of almost hope, like that kid at school that's good at everything, that he might be quite a bad bloke. But quite the opposite. He's got a brilliant energy about him. Just such a someone who's just interested in everyone else in the Quest team, and very, very enjoyable spending the day with him, especially as results went his way. But those teams who did play, Blackpool and Bristol Rovers, we'll start with, because Joey Barton, very vocal ahead of the Blackpool-Fleetwood game. He was really whipping this game up. I think some Blackpool fans sort of think that Fleetwood are trying to create this as this big derby, which Blackpool have never really considered it to be, as they've only played each other a handful of times. But either way, Blackpool doing the business, and they're now fourth in the table, which, I mean, it's a confusing league table, but that is quite a confusing aspect of it.
Yeah, Joey Barton certainly, Joey Barton the player, let's say, coming out in full force before this game, and it certainly backfired. It's been something that we've seen surprisingly little of, I'd say, is Barton's personality, but the quotes...
one high-profile incident, yeah, allegedly, last year.
Allegedly, but I think he'd probably rather we didn't know about that. Yeah, saying that Blackpool aren't a big club and all this stuff, it's just, it's fairly naive stuff, and... you know, the old cliche of doing Simon Grayson's team talk for him, and that's how it played out.
How often do you think something is actually pinned up on the wall of the dressing
room? Very rarely, I reckon.
I can't imagine.
Well, I just can't imagine they have very many, like, you know, suitable walls.
Is there blue tack?
Exactly, but that's not pinned up. You'd have to use a pin, yeah.
I think these days people would suggest not pinning anything into the wall.
I agree.
Very bad for the structure of the building.
And you might not get your deposit back.
You definitely don't get your deposit back. I can speak from experience there.
Anyway, but Blackpool generally, I've we've said it all season, I find it very, very difficult to get a good steer on them and how good they are. But, you know, we're in mid-December now and they are sitting in fourth position. Who are we to tell them they're not one of the teams pushing for automatic promotion?
What's weird about the league at the moment is it's another league where it's very congested. 3 points between Peterborough in third and Fleetwood in ninth. You can kind of extend that and play with that however you want. But one of the weird parts of it is, if you go on the Soccer Stats website, you get the normal league table, but you can look at the points per game as well, which helps when there's so many teams on different games played. You've got Fleetwood, who are ninth, with 1.71 points per game, and Blackpool, who are fourth, who just beat them, with a worse points per game, 1.68. So I would suggest the league table, not all that it seems, but what is undeniable is that Blackpool, and especially Nondwier, Feeney and Kaikai, are proving consistently good this season. Nondwier in a way that he's never been before. It's already his best ever goal scoring season. He's got 11 in 17. Previous best was 10 in 43. Kaikai having a run of games, playing consistently, always felt like he was going to thrive at this level. And that's what Simon Grayson has done with him. And he is thriving. A sensational goal on the weekend. And Feeney sort of sneaking around and racking up the assists more than anyone else in League One. It's just absolutely fantastic and working so well with Nondwier. So not to say that the midfield and defence aren't doing their part, but that's what stands out every time Blackpool win, is that it's the same guys we're talking about. With Bristol Rovers, George, we won't get too overexcited about beating Southend at home. Southend admittedly scored two quite nice goals in the first half, but they are still historically terrible defensively.
But I think, you know, we need to give them some credit, because this is, I mean, it's a bit ridiculous, because it's two games in a row where they have been beaten and conceded four goals, once against Oxford and once against Bristol Rovers. But in both games, they were the better side for periods, which is something we couldn't say under Kevin Bond.
That's true.
And we couldn't say in the interim period either. So, I mean, playing well for 20 minutes in a 90-minute match and being terrible for the other 70 minutes isn't going to keep you up. But slowly, maybe Sol Campbell's getting somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Graham Coughlan certainly getting somewhere with this Bristol Rovers team, because it's now a year since he's been in charge, since Daryl Clark left. And just a reminder that on the 9th of December 2018, they were 21st in Sky Bet League One. That is a relegation spot. They had 17 points from 21 games. And on the 9th of December this year, 5th in League One with 31 points from 18 games. So with largely the same squad, I can't think of a huge amount of transfer business being done in or out over the summer. There was a few of their players that left and joined the Daryl Clark revolution at Walsall, but otherwise, not a huge amount of squad churn, and it's hugely impressive for Coughlan, who you could tell from his post-match interview is a fairly no-nonsense bloke. The team plays in his image, that's for sure. When they don't pick up results, the style can be quite turgid, which leads to some grumbling from fans, but they are picking up the results at the moment, so it's happy days. He's now been in charge for 48 league games, and they've got 78 points in that time, which is essentially playoff chasing form, and that is a hell of a turnaround from where they were this time last year. So big credit to him. Lovely goal from Ed Upson there in that game to make it 3-2. Rochdale winning at Rotherham was definitely the longest priced winner of the weekend. And given that you were very kind to mention my good prediction of Bristol City doing the business against Fulham, I should flag up that I thought Rotherham would absolutely thrash Rochdale. I think I picked them -1 on the betting show. So, and this is clearly a shock for me, but
how are you coping with it?
Well, not that well, because it was a good week for me otherwise. I got the other two in, and I'm a bit disappointed with this. But it's hard to be too angry when you see a Rochdale Academy graduate, of whom they have many, absolutely swatting one in from 25 yards after a lovely little dummy from Callum Camps, another Youth Academy graduate. The assist went to Matheson, the 16-year-old playing right back, possibly 17 now, I can't remember when his birthday is. And it's just, you know, I feel like I do this bit about Rochdale and their academy every time they win.
There's nothing else to say.
Don't talk much about them when they lose five in a row, as they did before this game. But I guess the other notable thing for me was Robert Sanchez in goal for them, who we've given a lot of stick to, correctly so, this season, for enjoying periods of the game where he either is passing to the opposition or just in absolute no man's land. But he had a fantastic afternoon. All the Rotherham fans were saying, look, one of our big strengths is crosses into the box, and he just came and claimed every single one. So well done to Sanchez. Rotherham, having gone into that with 6 wins in 9, and in fourth, I think, at the start of the weekend, not doing very well on the weekend. Gillingham beat Sunderland 1-0. George, before we talk about Sunderland, well done to Gillingham. I think it's always important not to go straight to
pay off Gillingham.
Some people consider to be the headline news. What a goal from Ogilvy of Gillingham, and they were pretty good for it. I think there was a bit of controversy with a disallowed goal that I think was probably the right call in the end, with 09 close to or wrestling the goalkeeper, but Gillingham getting the win and doing enough at the moment to move away from the relegation places. That's fair to say.
Yeah, and they hit the woodwork twice in the game as well. So I think if you're a Sunderland fan feeling hard done by here, you're probably clutching at straws a little bit. Just 7 shots for Sunderland again. Phil Parkinson has managed to create a team who find it very, very difficult to get in positions to shoot, which is as damning.
Is that good or is that bad?
That is bad.
Bad,
that
right,
is
okay.
Bad.
Yeah.
And defensively, they're not particularly solid either. So, you know, I was a big advocate of Parkinson's when he got the job. I thought at worst he was a safe pair of hands. That has proven not to be the case at the moment. And in the same way with Paul Cook, I've been waiting to see a press release today from Sunderland, but nothing coming yet.
Are you on their mailing list for press releases?
No, of course I'm not. No, but yeah, I mean, I'm surprised, but you've got to give Steve Evans credit as well. I feel like Gillingham are one of the teams at the moment who are on a little good run without getting many plaudits. You know, in all, they of course went to AFC Wimbledon and were beaten in their last league game. But in all competitions, they are unbeaten in 6 or 7, I think, now. And if they can transfer their good cup form into the league, they'll be in good shape, because they've beaten some decent teams there, including Sunderland. And you know, it's been a very quiet Steve Evans season so far. Almost, you know, you almost have to remind yourself that he's managing in League One, because he's not necessarily as loud as he usually is. I think the reason for that is because normally he's managing teams who are doing quite well, and this time that hasn't really been the case. But more results like this, and maybe we'll hear more from Steve.
He did manage to have a bit of a row with Paul Lambert a couple of weeks ago, I seem to remember. I mean, the thing I kept coming back to with Sunderland on the weekend, because it's just such a miserable situation, and it, you know, I'm almost at the point of just not necessarily knowing exactly where to apportion blame and how to analyse this. They've lost 8 and 12 under Parkinson. But what I kept coming back to was, with the caveat, with recognition that I've never been a manager of a football club, and there's more to it than just, it's not Football Manager where you just, or FIFA where you just put the best players on the pitch. There's man management to think about. There's squad morale, etc. But Duncan Watmore, Aidan McGeady, and Chris Maguire sitting on the bench for the whole game, one of them being brought on in the 92nd minute. I can't stop coming back to that when I was thinking about this game, so I'm just going to leave that there. And lastly, a big win for Michael Appleton, George, and Lincoln City, because they've been having a tough time recently.
I didn't want to say anything, but I've been slowly watching them sink in League One, alarmingly. What I would say to Lincoln fans is that Michael Appleton's heroic tenure at Oxford started with a very, very poor sixth-month spell. So hopefully this is a result and a performance that will get things going again, because the post-Cowley hangover has been a tough one. Michael Appleton has struggled to really get much of a tune out of this Lincoln side, which, you know, there's absolutely no question that the attacking talents that he can, you know, that he can use should be doing more at this level. But really good to see them go to Burton, a team who I think, you know, we spoke the other day about how they hadn't played many home games this season, and therefore there'd be one to kind of keep an eye on as those home games came. But Lincoln a decent value for their win. Really important that Tyler Walker, after a bit of a barren spell, is back on the score sheet as well. And fingers crossed that Michael Appleton can start. Some of the fruits of his labour at Lincoln we'll start to see fairly soon.
No doubt he'll be working very hard to turn that one around. Macclesfield, George, in League Two, didn't play this weekend. Their players refused to play based on not being paid their wages for last month, or being paid late again, something that's happened for several months. The players rightly pointing out in a status how much that situation affects both their physical health in terms of not being able to train, but also their mental health and their financial well-being. mortgages to pay, and issues coming when your own salary is not guaranteed or is not guaranteed to be paid on time. A bit of hope in this Macclesfield situation, George. The current owner releasing a statement on the weekend saying he is in talks to sell the club. I mean, that absolutely has to happen. And it has to happen pretty soon, because rather than just shouting the word Berry, I mean, it could very easily turn into a situation like that. And you spoke about this about a month ago. You need to keep making sure the message is getting out there.
Yeah, the one thing I would say, and it's obviously it's very sad that Macclesfield couldn't play their game on Saturday, and you'd think there's going to be a punishment of sorts, whether that's financial or points based. But it looks like it may have triggered some kind of action. If you think back, Bury last season, their players were in a very similar position. They continued to play. They won promotion, and the club, as we know, it doesn't exist anymore. So in taking this fairly extreme measure, hopefully it's going to put the pressure on Amar Al-Qadi to sell the club. I mean, I urge caution, because, I mean, going back to when I supported Oxford United under the ownership of Firas Kassam, through to what we see at the moment with Bury and Bolton, when you've got an owner who isn't particularly popular, who's running a club at a loss for the club and personally, words don't mean very much, and it's the actions that actually are going to change things. So whilst the press release obviously says that he's willing to sell and that he's got buyers, let's just put the champagne on ice until it's all gone through, because this isn't sorted yet.
At the top of League Two, Swindon establishing themselves as the top team with 6 wins in a row, West Brom and Leeds-esque from Richie Wellens' Swindon. It's not all about Owen Doyle, but it is a lot about Owen Doyle, because he has now scored in 8 consecutive games. He's scored Swindon's first goal in 8 consecutive games, the game's first goal in 7 of the 8. And the second top scorer in League 2 also plays for Swindon in Jerry Yates, and he was probably the star on the weekend, beating this grim Grimsby Town team, who are just going from... What's the opposite of strength to strength? They're going from weakness to weakness, Grimsby, in the last few months, which is very concerning. Swindon made them pay. It looked pretty straightforward. Yates with some eye-catching goals. But like all top teams, it's not just about the strikers for Swindon. Grant is getting a lot of praise for his performances in midfield, breaking up the play, distributing the ball well. Isgrove, when he's played, he's obviously had an injury a lot recently, but has racked up the assists when he's played. Jordan Lydon as well. And Keshi Anderson contributing while not scoring loads. Such a clever player and so tricky. Quite a weird one though, George. I mean, they've played 7 of the top 10 and they've got 3 draws and 4 defeats from those games. No wins. They've played 13 of the bottom 14 and won 12 and lost just 1. So at the moment, there's this quite clear difference between their performances against the good teams and the very, very poor teams. And while on the Quest show, Gareth Ainsworth and Sam Saunders didn't seem to be too concerned about that, it would be something that I'd certainly be looking at, because, you know, they're going to have some pretty big games against some pretty good teams coming up, and they haven't been very good in those games recently. I'm just, for your sake, I'm trying to find something other than Swindon are incredible, because I know that that is a state of affairs that you're not that keen on as an Oxford fan.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to look at the team top of the table on the run that we're on and find fault, because there's a decent chance that the stats you plucked out there may be something of a coincidence. We're going to find out fairly soon if that is the case. But you look at their recent results and, you know, they beat a Mansfield team who I guess are struggling, and a Salford team who you know, aren't really pushing for promotion, a Grimsby team who are really, really struggling, and the next game is Oldham at home. But I would say that I think they are better set and they're playing better football now than they were earlier in the season when maybe they did drop those points. So I'm not sitting here as an Oxford fan waiting on them to slip up. I think they look like the class team in the league.
Yep, fair point. To counteract what I started, a lot of the top teams they have played, Exeter, Cheltenham, Crewe and Bradford, they all played away from home. So the other five teams that make up the top six, they haven't played any of them at home yet. So when they do play them, at least they'll have home advantage. Scunthorpe are probably on the second best run of League Two teams now that Northampton have lost on the weekend at Exeter. And Paul Hurst turning it around. I mean, it'll be easy for us to say we always saw it coming and we knew that given time that would happen. But it's not always the case. So I think that there's probably a bit more to it than like, wow, this was always going to happen. The tune that he's getting from Issa and Gilead on the flanks, the partnership of Von Veen and Novak has turned them into an actual attacking threat, which early in the season they were struggling so, so much with. But tightening up as well. You know, they're only up in 14th now, but unbeaten in six. They've won five of their last eight. Keeping the opposition's goals down, that's kind of the real key. And it's good to see because as a NTT20 meets guest, Paul Hurst was a delight on our playoff preview last season. He was a real delight, and I'm very glad to see them doing well. Exeter beating Northampton, another big result in League Two. Northampton had been on that crazy run, I think five wins in six, but this was their big test, and they failed it.
They did, but I mean... with a caveat of it being a very, very tough game. I think losing 3-2 away at Exeter isn't going to be something that shows that they're not up to the task, because I think a point would have been a very good result. But disappointing for them. I mean, this was a game, I think, for both managers, was one that they'd have been desperate to win, because they know they're against a team who's going to be challenging towards the top end. It wouldn't be a massive surprise to see these two meeting again in the playoffs towards the end of the season. Mm. And... yeah, you say they failed it. To take the lead away from home and to squander that, and then be 3-1 down is going to be a bit of a blow. Good to see friend of the pod Alex Fisher getting on the score sheet.
Great to see,
with a very, very important goal as well.
Serious delivery that from youngster Jack Sparks through the academy at Exeter. Unbelievable left-footed cross on the half volleys.
It's just another example of why Matt Taylor is so impressive. I spoke to people at Oxford after our EFL trophy game with them midweek, and everyone just said how impressed they were by how positive everyone is at the club about the current regime, how much the players are enjoying it, how Taylor's a very good talker. It just feels like a club that's slightly galvanised, and we think back to Paul Tisdale when he left, and you know, if you fast forward 18 months and saw the kind of rich vein of form that Exeter in compared to their manager, who's now back looking for another job. It's massive testament to him. I think if we were to do kind of alternative awards, I think Matt Taylor would be one of the guys who should be up there for best manager of the year.
Yeah, I don't know who takes credit for recruitment there, but Randall Williams has been an excellent signing. They picked him up in January, and he is absolutely ripping it up this season in League Two. 9 assists, which is 3 more than the next best assist maker in League Two. A ball carrying ability, a dribbling ability, and a left footed delivery. Which is probably getting close to unrivaled in League Two. So really good start to the season for him. And there were loads of 1-0s, all of them impressive performances, impressive wins, but we're not going to go deep on Bradford 1, Newport 0, which was two teams playing three at the back, which is kind of my big bugbear at the moment. Never seems to turn into a good game when that's the case, and that certainly happened at Bradford. Cambridge beat Plymouth 1-0. Colchester beat Salford 1-0. Walsall beat Port Vale 1-0. Very impressive away win for Darrell Clark's team in what was a poor game. But the last team to touch on in a little bit of depth, George, is Cheltenham. They beat Mansfield 3-0. And they've had to have a bit of a rethink with Luke Varney out long-term with a knee injury. And I liked the discussion on Quest about these two guys up front. Jonte Smith, who you'll know because Oxford plucked him from non-league in January, where he'd been banging them in for Lewis in the Isthmian League for a few years. Didn't make the grade at Oxford, but's now turned up at Cheltenham and is getting a chance in Varney's absence. And Alex Adai, who has also come up through non-league, also 25 years old, tore up the Isthmian League with the pod favourite non-league team, Kingstonian, is one of Kingstonian's fans' most popular players of their modern era. And he actually genuinely looks like, out of the two of them, the one that could go even higher. Real pace. He's very small, very tricky, really tough to tackle. Excellent on the counter-attack and with Ryan Broom. those two on the counter looks like a very, very deadly thing. What I wanted to ask you, which I was just a bit confused about more than anything, is looking at the betting in League Two at the moment, because it's still pretty top, pretty tight towards the top. Cheltenham and Crewe are on the same amount of points from the same amount of games. Cheltenham's goal difference is 6 goals better than Crewe, but they're 25-1 to win League Two, and Crewe are 5-1 to win League Two. And I wanted to ask you, as someone who knows a bit more than me about this stuff, why that might be. Is it just wrong? Because it sounds wrong to me.
Yeah, it looks wrong to me. I think it's probably something to do with Crewe's, Crewe were the favourites to win the league before Swindon's good run, and maybe the market hasn't reacted enough to push them out as far as they should be. With Cheltenham, again, a club who are priced up as being lower mid-table at the beginning of the season, naturally, at this stage, it's not going to take some time to catch up. The numbers that I've seen in terms of underlying data suggest that there isn't too much between them. That's why I flag Crewe as being a team who maybe were in a bit of a false position. So I can't really give you an answer, I'm afraid. Just get on,
Okay, nice. Well, I mean, they're very solid at the back, as we know. Cheltenham, dangerous on the counter-attack. I think the concern would be if they do start to establish themselves as one of the very top teams in the division. Not sure they've got a huge amount of creativity in terms of unlocking defences that would sit deep against them. If teams start to go there or come up against Cheltenham and look for a point, that's when I could see them slightly flattering to deceive. And that's something that, lots of teams suffer with. So I might be wrong. Last but not least, Jonte Smith, his dad is the Bermuda national cricket team coach. Quite fun.
Lovely.
Thanks very much, George. Thank you, listeners. This has been Not the Top 20 podcast, and we're still very much in debt to you for helping us share the podcast, helping us spread the word, but we are still asking you to do so. A retweet of the podcast on Twitter, send the link to a mate, anything really. It's just so helpful for us to continue to grow, continue to reach new people. So thank you for listening. We'll be back later on in the week with a betting show. You're going to hear George on Guardian Football Weekly. You might hear or see us elsewhere this week as well. So thank you for your continued support. And we'll chat again later on in the week.